Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was supported through the Melbourne City Revitalisation Fund, a $200 million partnership of the Victorian Government and the City of Melbourne.
Hey everyone! Welcome to the Melbourne Writers Festival. How is everyone? Yeah? My name's Benjamin Law. I'm so happy to be here with you all tonight, even though I can't see you because the lights are so intense. But the vibe is good, and I'm so thrilled to be joining you here on the lands of the Wurundjeri, the Woiwurrung, and the Boonwurrung people. First Nations people on this continent have been sharing stories and knowledge and food, of course, here for tens of thousands of years, and together they collectively form the oldest continuing civilization this planet has ever seen. And we are very grateful to elders past and present that we can continue sharing all of those things here on what is and what will always be Aboriginal land. I'm also really excited about tonight's event and tonight's guest, because our guest tonight isn't just a cookbook author. She's a proper food icon. And we know this because celebrities are often known just by a singular name, right? Like Madonna, Cher, Beyonce. But I believe you become an icon in food when people know your recipes by definitive hashtags. The cookies, the stew, the pasta. And of course, the creator of those recipes has written for Bon Appetit, BuzzFeed, and the New York Times. Her YouTube specials rack over a million views, and her three cookbooks, Dining In, Nothing Fancy, and now, Sweet Enough, have together sold roughly 500,000 copies worldwide. And her recipes are so popular, I'm pretty sure they're the biggest cause of ingredient shortages, second only to coronavirus. Please welcome her to the Melbourne Writers Festival, Alison Roman.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.
And that's the event, and
know,
we can
and
now
thank
leave.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I still don't know how to sit in a chair. They're very deep. It's harder than
Do you
it
watch
looks.
Succession? We can be like Kieran Culkin and his
that's
awkward
not,
sitting.
Yeah, that's not a good look
in
for
a chair.
Me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alison, correct me if I'm wrong. This is not just your first time in Melbourne, it is your first time on this continent.
It is, in Australia. I made it, finally.
So my question is, what gives? Why has it taken so long?
Because I was supposed to come in March of 2020.
Oh.
And so they were not going to cancel the food festival. And I was like, are you sure? It feels like things are getting a little weird. And they're like, no, it's fine. We're fine. And then Tom Hanks got COVID in Australia. And they were like, shut it down. Nobody's coming. And so that's what happened.
And things just kept happening from
there. And
from
they just
there.
Kept on happening. Yeah, that was it.
How long have you been in Australia now?
For 2 days, I think. Okay. I don't know what day it is, honestly. I think it's 2 days.
And have you, I don't know, fit in any good food experiences yet?
I have. The food has absolutely delivered in a way that I was promised.
Uh-huh.
But also I was sort of lured to, I'm going to mispronounce it, Melbourne.
yeah.
Because they're like, well, Melbourne is like New York. And I was like, say no more. I get it. And I kind of feel that. And I feel like energetically the restaurants have like really, they feel distinct and different, mm-hmm. But also familiar and New York-y. And I like that.
And you also had your first Tim Tam.
Did I ever? And I was really prepared to sort of feel lukewarm on it.
Uh-huh.
And I was so obsessed with it immediately. It was perfect. But I will say, and I said this in an interview the other day, people kept encouraging me to do the Tim Tam Slam. But I was like, I feel like if somebody's recommending that to me, they don't know me.
Yeah.
Because if you know me, you know that I hate soggy foods. And I hate a crispy food that's then made soggy. Like chicken parm or like a, what's another example? Like I dip my pancakes instead of pouring syrup on them. I don't like it if you're going to spend the effort to make something crispy to then make it soft.
I don't think you're obliged to use a cookie / biscuit as a straw.
No, but grow up. You know, we're adults here. Like, come on. It's a perfect food. It doesn't need to be soaked in a liquid.
And this is like high praise for you because like sometimes you're a little bit like about cookies in general, right? Like,
but this is definitively like a biscuit treat.
Yeah.
You know, it's like not so much a cookie. It's like almost Kit Kat-esque. It's like wafery. It's like really a class of its own.
I almost just want to just reel in every variation of Tim Tam and just have you taste test
it. We do have
tonight,
an hour. We can spend our time that way.
We're going to move on. We're going to move on. You are synonymous with New York City, but you didn't grow up on that side of the country. You grew up on the West Coast.
In California, yes.
So what was food like growing up there? What are your earliest memories of food?
I grew up in L.A., and my dad was not much of a cook himself, but he was really very much an eater. And I think maybe because my dad grew up in Los Angeles, it was very much like eating at the restaurants in L.A. was a part of like our bonding time and how we spent time together. We would go to Carney's for the hot dogs and Langer's for the pastrami and sort of eat that way. But also in the San Fernando Valley where I grew up, it was like very easy to get pretty much anything you want and like the best version of it. Like we had the best Thai food, the best Mexican food, the best Jewish deli food. Like everything was sort of right there. And it really took for granted like that was just, I thought everybody grew up that way. It wouldn't occur to me that you wouldn't have access to so much all the time.
So it sounded like you could take good food for granted, but were you interested in food? Like there's often a difference, right? Like you can really eat well, but that doesn't mean you're interested in food. Like were you interested at a young age?
I think so. I mean, I think it's so primal when things taste good. You're like, I'm happy. And you want to keep feeling happy. You want to keep feeling good. So I think that on that level, it was something that I always enjoyed doing. And, but it wasn't like investigative. I wasn't like, I got to get to the bottom of this. And how is this made? Like I didn't have any sort of that energy until I became more interested in cooking. And that was really more of like, I became interested in cooking because I think I was really procrastinating. I was like, I'd rather not do homework. I'd rather not do anything else. And cooking was like a way to provide a service. And like, you know, you could sort of say, well, I didn't do my chores and I didn't do my homework, but I did make dinner. And so like, who's gonna be mad at that? You know? And so I felt like it was that.
That's pretty cool to have a kid in the family who's like making everyone dinner though. Like that feels like a good deal.
It was like, well, you still have to do your homework, you know? Yeah. But I did think it was a creative way, workaround.
Mm-hmm. And so that interest in food, I mean, let me know if I've got any of these details wrong, but you left college, right, to work for, I think it was like $7 an hour initially in the food industry as a pastry chef to begin with. What were you studying at college and why did you leave for this very different life?
It was a different life, yeah. I mean... Basically, I went to college because that was like what everybody did. It wasn't because I had like a passion for learning. And like, I also didn't know what I wanted to do. And who really does at that age? It's so absurd that we send people to school to be like, well, decide now and you're 19. And, but I had started cooking recreationally, reading a lot of cookbooks around that time and just was like super, enchanted by it and really ignited by the idea of like using my brain creatively that also resulted in like a physical something. And it was like firing on all cylinders. Like it made me feel like intellectually stimulated, creatively stimulated. It was a physical job. And I just decided that I could always go back to school, but I wasn't sure how long this interest would last.
I mean, you're pitching it really passionately to me. Like, I'm feeling all of that.
Yeah.
But, like, when you tell your parents, like, I'm leaving college to do this.
Yeah, it wasn't that articulate then. they were not sold. No, they were not. They weren't pleased.
They were not pleased.
No.
You are basically like the white equivalent of an Asian kid saying, "I'm going to work in the arts."
Yeah, basically. Yeah, that was me.
Yeah. And so, where do you end up? You end up at Sona first, is that right?
Yeah, it was a restaurant called Sona, and basically, my only concern was making enough money to make rent.
Okay.
Which at that point was like $8.50 a month for a studio apartment, you know. And it was down the street. But at that time, you know, in a restaurant in like a fine dining capacity, you're spending all your time at work. Mm-hmm. You eat all your meals there. You get there at 11. You leave at 1. And there's no time to spend money anywhere else. So, like, as long as you can pay your rent, you're sort of fine. But my parents were very clear. They were like, "We're not going to give you money to just do whatever you want." And I was like, "Well, I'm going to do whatever I want." And that was sort of the take that I had indefinitely.
So a really sink or swim situation. And was the environment as stressful as outsiders would believe? Because there is this perception that inside the kitchen, it's like just abuse and horror and heat and sweating and tears. I mean, how much of that is true?
It was a lot of tears, but I'm a crier. So is it because it was terrible or is it because I like to cry? We don't know. But it was really intense, but it was also my first real job. I worked at Jamba Juice, which is a American smoothie chain.
Yeah. And
like I was a receptionist at a day spa, like when I was in high school, but this was like my first real job. So I didn't know anything else.
Mm.
And I think that there wasn't any sort of culture shock because it was the first job that I had. So I didn't know any better. And I liked the intensity.
Mm.
Like everybody cared so much, and it's sort of like, I don't know, it is, I guess, a bit, people that work in restaurants, I think, are attracted to it because, I don't know, there's a lot of psychology behind it, and I can't speak for everybody who's worked in a restaurant, but I do think that there is like a drive to belong to something, and like mm-hmm. you're sort of, it's a little culty, but like you really do sort of give it your all.
Yeah.
But I liked that. It was a very family-oriented vibe, like for better or for worse. But it wasn't super heinous. I was often the only woman, and I was definitely the youngest person
right.
at pretty much every restaurant I worked at. But for that reason, I think I got more of like a little sister treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Like I wasn't the victim of like sexual abuse, and I didn't witness it either. It was pretty much just guys being assholes and to each other and sometimes to me, but
it just sounds like guys.
Yeah, it
really.
Wasn't. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary, you know.
Yeah. So, you go Sona, Pies and Thighs, I think Momofuku Milk Bar.
I worked in San Francisco for 4 years at a restaurant, but yeah,
okay,
basically
yeah.
California chapter, then New York chapter.
And how does working in restaurants change your relationship to food? Because I can imagine that people are put through that industry and it's like, actually, like, you know, I'm losing my passion for it. Or does it actually increase your interest in what you're doing?
Well, what was interesting is that I didn't lose my interest in food, but I did sort of over the course of the 7 years that I worked in a mixture of restaurants and bakeries and things like that, I sort of realized, well, I don't want to own my own restaurant and I don't want to work for someone else's vision. So it's like, well, at that point, what are you left with? You can't really work in a restaurant anymore. And I sort of segued out of restaurants by working in a bakery, but that ended up also just sort of taking over my life. And I sort of just quit working in any sort of service industry and transitioned to editorial, which was a really different career path, but used the same sort of interest in food, but just from a different entrance.
And what was the motivation for getting into that realm?
I think that I was tired of the food being like a short-lived performance. Mm. You know, like you're in a restaurant, you're cooking food for somebody, you have an impact on their life in that moment. And they eat the food and they're like, "That was amazing." And then they go home and they probably don't, you know, like that's it. The tale is very short. And what I realized I loved so much about my job is that I really loved teaching people how to cook. Like when a new person would come into the kitchen and I would have to, you know, train them, I really enjoyed, you know, giving like the how and the why behind what we were doing.
Mm.
And, you know, that can only go so far when you're just in a small kitchen. But it didn't occur to me that like, oh, I need to reach a larger audience. It wasn't like that. I just knew that I was ready to have like a different sort of impact, or I wanted to have a different avenue for which to like showcase interest in cooking.
So we're talking about food media, and I work in the media, and people in the media, I guess, like to gossip, but I also like to gossip about the media.
And
you've worked at Bon Appetit.
I did.
You've worked at BuzzFeed.
I did.
You've worked at the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Give us the inside scoop.
I'm not going to give you the full scoop. We don't have that much time. But it was all really different. And I worked at all those places at very, very different times than are now. Like, when I worked at Bon Appetit, Instagram didn't really exist. It was, I think you mentioned, it was like the year that I started, Instagram became an app. Just imagine that for a second.
And it was just at that stage, just like filtered photos. I didn't even know if the grid existed at that
terrible.
Stage.
Yeah. It was terrible. I mean, it's embarrassing. What if everybody goes back to like the first Instagram they ever had, it's like a grainy photo of your cat. It's like not interesting. It's not good. But it is pure. Mm-hmm, it was really pure.
Mm-hmm. We were more innocent back then.
We really were, weren't we? And I think that like working at a magazine when the internet was really deprioritized, they sort of made fun of people who wrote for the website.
Oh, they're the online people.
Yeah, it was like, oh, well, we do this for print, but like not for, like, or if it was like a bad idea, they'd be like, well, put it online. You know, it was like totally treated like this thing that nobody was ever going to pay attention to. And it's just so funny that like that was my introduction into media.
Because that must have been such a contrast with BuzzFeed, which is just like everything's online. And if it doesn't work online, it doesn't work.
Yeah. And I took that job because I had been at Bon Appetit for 4 years and had kind of reached my capacity. I wasn't going to ever make more money than I was making. I wasn't ever going to have like a better role or more power or like more influence. And I could have stayed there forever. And I was like, you know, I think if I stay here, I'll be Allison from Bon Appetit forever. Or the girl from Bon Appetit. Like, people wouldn't even know my name necessarily. And I just felt like I wanted a bit more. And when you work for any sort of company, newspaper, magazine, whatever, your work is influenced by a lot of other people. Like, the creative direction, the word count, the, like, everything is touched by a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I sort of just wanted it. I was like, well, I don't always like these decisions creatively. So I kind of made the decision that it was time to go.
Mm-hmm.
It was really hard. I had a really tough time leaving. I cried every day after I took the job at BuzzFeed. I thought I had ruined my life and I was like never going to recover. And it was like, I made a horrible choice. And I knew from the second I stepped foot in those offices that it wasn't for me, but I did want to know.
I proved myself correct.
It was also my birthday. That like my first day at work was my birthday.
Happy birthday.
And I was like, I'm in hell. This is hell. But I wanted to know because everyone was like, the internet is the future. The internet is the future of media. And I hadn't had any experience working on the internet because I was working for a print magazine.
Yep.
And so I took the job because I was like, well, I can't really know unless I try.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hated it.
Yeah.
So I stopped. And it wasn't, I mean, I worked for the internet other places now. I feel like I still do. But it was just like internet-based culture and like different style of content.
And when it comes to that presentation of food, what specifically did you hate about it?
Where to start? I feel like I take food so seriously and like food is my entire existence and I'm very protective of it. Like I care deeply about the integrity of like recipe writing and cooking and I take it really seriously. And
were they doing?
I felt like not taking it seriously.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're making a mockery of my career. And like, you know, it felt like we were just on different pages because food had become like a thing that anyone could do or talk about. And it was the beginning of like viral recipes of like an Oreo stuffed into a thing and then like made into a cake. And you're like, why? Like, I was like, well, no one's going to make that, you know? And so it was tough.
So you go from BuzzFeed, rest in peace, or at least the news division.
Yeah.
It's been a grim time over there.
It's dark in media, my friends. It's dark.
But then you talk about viral recipes, right? And when you're over at the New York Times, we're skipping ahead a bit. I mean, we're talking about the pasta. We're talking about the stew. We're talking about the cookies. I can't think of more viral recipes than I don't know, like a recipe that becomes the definitive kind of hashtag there. So, like, what was it like as the author of those recipes to see them taking off? And what was your theory as to like why they were so passionately embraced?
Well, it was It was cool because the first one that happened was the cookies, and that happened before I was at the New York Times, and it came from a cookbook. Mm. Like, it came from, like, a bound book of pages. Like, it didn't come from the internet, and it wasn't designed to go viral. And having been on the other side of that, of like, okay, well, we're going to engineer recipes that are going to get a ton of views, this was like just a recipe that was part of a collection that I thought was really good. And so to have it become so widely shared, but it wasn't just widely shared, people were actually making them. And that was, to me, the thing that like really set it apart in the like quote unquote viral movement, because a viral article is just something that you send to somebody and it gets sent around and everybody reads it. But like, to go to the store and buy the ingredients and like follow their directions and make the thing and chill the dough for 2 full hours, even though you don't want to, is like a real investment. And so I felt like that was a real testament to people's enthusiasm for wanting to be a part of something and not just like passively ingest it, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah. Can we talk about the stew?
We can talk about the stew.
Okay. Because like, I've made the stew. I think half of you here have made the stew. It's delicious. Those of you who haven't made it should make it. It's spiced chickpea stew with coconut and turmeric. Mm-hmm. Now, food is emotional. People got emotional over the stew, which is to say some people might have lost their minds, but some people did see it as part of like a broader conversation about food and the politics of food. I think like one of the most like maybe most blunt ways that I saw that the argument was framed was, is this stew, quote, making money off brown food by essentially gentrifying it? What's your take and how does a criticism like that land with you?
It doesn't feel great. It's painful. It feels like, you know, I think that there, again, to your point, it's like a larger conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think when it comes to gentrification or appropriation, there are a million conversations we could have about like lots of different art forms, music, clothing, food. And I think sometimes unknowingly stepping into something when you're like, oh, I thought we were all just cooking with these things, and like understanding that food is emotional. And I had a lot of conversations with a lot of people that were really generous and like kind and warm and like, here's why this is painful and here's why this is hurting me or why this hit me the wrong way. But I think it took like a sort of a swelling of people to like all come and like talk about it in a way that was, that like made it evident to me, I guess. And I learned a lot from that, but I also, it was around for so long and then people were upset after the fact. And so there were a lot of, I think people were like uncomfortable to talk about it maybe, or didn't know if anybody else felt that way, or I don't know. I think that for me, again, like growing up in a place where I'm eating all types of foods, or like in a restaurant where like we were cooking with Japanese ingredients and Thai ingredients and we called it fusion or whatever. And I think that having like cooking with a global pantry is something that we, especially in like large metropolitan cities, take for granted. And it's just like, oh, everyone has turmeric in their pantry and everyone has fish sauce and everyone has, you know, whatever. But I think when the complaints that I received or like the engagements that I had with people, it was like, I got made fun of for this and now you're celebrated for this and that's painful. And like, I heard that and I was like, I can't imagine what that's like. And felt like it was worth it to have the conversation, because I think a lot of people in my position that write recipes, that write cookbooks, that are just trying to be like, what tastes good, have started to sort of think about, you know, that in a different way and just say like, oh, well, here's where this comes from. And like, that goes such a long way.
You have also caused ingredient shortages in supermarkets. And I need you to explain a tone all of this. Like, you have created, like, in, like, delis and grocery stores shortages.
No more Bucatini. We're out.
Yeah. And Lubna as well. Like, is that the tipping point when you know, like, actually things are going good if I'm ruining supply chains?
Yeah, I want to destroy the supermarkets. Yeah, I think that, again, I think it's like a testament to people's trust. Also, I think that part of anybody's success as a cookbook author is having a good track record with success. And I'm only here on this stage or writing books because people like to cook the food. And like, if the recipes didn't work, or if they didn't taste good, or if they didn't feel good or a sense of accomplishment when they made them, nobody would continue making them. Like, you can't build a career off writing recipes or making cookbooks if like the people aren't actually making them. They're not ornamental. And so like I'm only successful because people cook the things, and I'm like endlessly grateful for that. And I think that it's a huge compliment if we don't have any more bucatini, and I'm sorry. But also, you know, yeah, it feels good.
Sorry, not sorry. you talk about your cookbooks. Let's talk about them. True or false, though, your first cookbook, in fact, the two-book deal that you first got represented an exit strategy from BuzzFeed.
Yeah. I basically waited for the first check to hit my bank account. And then I gave notice immediately.
You ran screaming.
Yeah, but I mean, again, like I didn't have money to count on, and so I had to like stay at this job that I hated until I had like a guaranteed something.
Yeah.
And so as soon as that happened, which took a few months, I was gone.
Yeah. Tell us about Dining In. So this is your debut cookbook, and what was the mission statement behind it? What did you want to do?
Well, I was approached by my editor, and she said, she'd emailed me out of the blue and was like, I noticed that all my favorite recipes have your name on them, like from Bon Appetit. I've like torn them out of the magazine and they all have your name on them. And would you ever write a cookbook? And I was like, oh, well, one day, but not now. Like I was...
Why did you think not now?
I just didn't think I was ready. I was like, oh, well, I'll write a cookbook one day when I'm like more seasoned in my career. And I had been cooking professionally for 8-9 years at this point, but I think that I still felt like not worthy of having a book with my name on it. I was just like, well, this is something that you do later on when you have earned like the ability to write a collection of recipes. And she's like, well, books take 2 years to make. So she's like, will you be ready in 2 years? I was like, oh yeah, okay, let's do it. But this was sort of also at a time where a lot of the cookbooks were like sheet pan dinners or, you know, weeknight suppers or, you know, gluten-free something. Like, they all had a hook. They all had, like, a thing, like, that you could peg. And she's like, well, so what's your thing? And I was like, what if the thing was just really good recipes that worked? And she's like, basically, in, like, so many words, was kind of like, you're not really famous enough for that, you know? Like, and I was like, okay, but, but what if it was just recipes that were good? And, like, I just, like, kept pitching that idea. And she was like, okay. She's like, if anyone can do it, maybe you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, no pressure. But also I did sort of believe in it as a concept because it was just simple and obvious to me of like, if I'm a home cook and I want to make dinner, I just want recipes that are good and work. Like that was, you know, it was sort of an easy pitch to myself, I guess. It was my pitch after all. that was it. And it was good, I think.
And then
I feel like it's dated now.
Well, let's go into Nothing Fancy, because I think that's when you came onto my radar, and I was just like, oh, I'm cooking a lot of stuff from this book. But I also remember reading through a lot of the stuff. I'm like, is this allowed? Is this legal? Like you know,
what?
like for instance, like one that you're allowed to have fun in the kitchen. Like,
oh,
I was
yeah,
just
a
finding
little,
it really
you know?
Stressful.
Yeah.
I was like, fruit on ice, is that legal? Like, I'm still taken, but if you haven't done fruit on ice... It's a crowd pleaser.
Just on ice. It's amazing.
And
yeah.
It's super Asian as well. You know, you get your Asian meal, you get fruit at the end, and it's just like, but it's with ice now.
Yeah.
And it's really, really
it makes a
cool.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what were the rules and, I guess, assumptions about food and hospitality that our generation, I think, have probably inherited that you kind of wanted to resist or break down?
Of, like, the old style
of
entertaining. But that was another thing, is that for the second book, my editor was like, so what do you want to do? And I was like, I really want to do a book about like having people over, like not entertaining, but like, you know, what to make when people come over. And she's like, entertaining books don't sell. She's like, no. And I was like, okay, but what if it's just like having people over? And she's like, fine. Like, you know, she was so reluctant to say yes, like every turn. But I was like, no, I really believe in that. And I think that that's always been sort of my goal, is like, I don't want to do the thing that's successful. I want to do the thing that there's like a need for. And just because it doesn't exist doesn't mean it couldn't work or couldn't be successful. And I think the like, oh, this doesn't work is silly, because you actually don't know what works. And I think that anytime something new comes along, it's because, and like, I don't know, you have to like take a chance and on something that isn't a guarantee.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to go straight into hyperbole, but I really do feel like that cookbook changed how a lot of people ate and how a lot of people had people over. In fact, when I was posting about the fact that I was interviewing you, I had like, you know, a fancy Sydney gay DM me, and it was just immediately...
Core demo of mine.
And it was just like photo after photo of all the Alison Roman dinners that he'd put on. I mean, how many of you had
it's
your
so
dinners
nice.
Changed by that cookbook? Like, yeah.
Thank you.
Like,
that's
it was,
really nice.
It was quite a moment. It was quite a moment.
It's very emotional, actually, and I feel like on this book tour, anytime, like, it's brought up or something, like, I do get very close to crying because it feels very personal, and also cooking is so personal, and when you, like, take a chance on buying a book or, like, investing into somebody, and, like, they become a part of your kitchen, and, like, they become, like, I don't know, it feels like a deep honor to, like, have that.
So between Cookbook 2 and Cookbook 3, a pandemic happens.
Oh, yeah.
Great. People lose a lot of stuff over that period. Like, people lose their livelihoods. People lose their way of life. People lose the ability to have people over.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us kind of lost our brains for a moment. And a lot of us went online to lose our brains.
Extremely online.
Yeah, and I've been an extremely online person, and I felt like I was losing my mind over this period as well. But then there was a whole period where people lost their mind against you. Mm. And we're not going to go through the specifics of what happened, because you can look that stuff up. There's like, yeah.
If you don't know, marry me. But yeah, if you can Google
and,
it.
And if you want, you can listen to the latest episode of Stop Everything, where we interviewed Beverly Wang. You were so game and jet lagged. And I think, like, you gave Beverly a hug afterwards. I wanted to give you a hug, but I was in Sydney. Anyway, you can catch up there. But I wanted to bring that up because I feel like you've experienced something on a level that a lot of us haven't, where you've been scrutinized and criticized in ways that we probably won't be able to understand. But I think a lot of people here can probably relate to the idea of feeling like you're at rock bottom and not knowing how to pick yourself up from that.
Mm-hmm.
So where were you and how did you pick yourself up?
Yeah, I think it's like at that time, most people on this planet were just not doing well. It was like whether you were really lonely or you lost your job or you were at home with someone you didn't want to be at home with, or just like a million ways to not be doing well. And then to, it's like to have that happen on such like an epic scale of like shame and embarrassment and like mortification and failure. And, you know, it was like, I had to be like, am I depressed because of the pandemic or because this thing happened to me, or is it both, or like, what's going on? Like, I couldn't really parse it out of like what was the cause, but it was like a pretty dark and bad time. But also, to your point earlier, I wasn't cooking for other people anyway. So there was that, and like to go through something where you feel like the whole world hates you and also be physically alone was extremely hard. And I think that I have a really amazing community of people around me that I've relied on throughout my whole life for just like mental health and emotional support and, you know, chosen family and all that. And so to not be with them physically was really painful, but we were there virtually. We were there in Zoom, which is awful. But so it was difficult to know like how to get out of that. But I think that for me, I didn't really have a choice. Like, I kind of had to figure something out. Like, I didn't have a job anymore and I wasn't sure like what was going to happen in the future. But like, I felt like a lot of us were in that place. I was just in it in a different way.
And just to clarify, when you say I didn't have a job anymore, this is a period where you're like, I think, is it you left the New York Times and there was like a divorce going on between you and the New York Times?
Yeah.
And then I remember you talking in an interview where you asked the question, if I'm not Alison Roman from the New York Times, who am I?
Yeah.
What was the answer that you found?
I guess just Alison Roman. thank you. but I think that was a similar feeling to when I left Bon Appetit to go to BuzzFeed, and it was like my whole external success was wrapped up belonging to this brand, and it felt very scary to leave because if I didn't have that support, would anyone care? And then I was able to kind of like figure my own thing out and then kind of quickly wound up again at the New York Times, like sort of writing for a brand. and achieved more success. And they sort of, there's a culture there that is like very, like, you're successful because you work at the New York Times and not because you're you. And so to lose that footing and then like really be alone and be like, well, no one's, I'm not like, I didn't leave to take another job. Like, I didn't know if anyone was going to hire me to do anything. And so I kind of had to figure out how to make something from nothing. And, you know, I say nothing. I still had like a really pretty large like base of people that were still interested in what I had to say or cook the recipes that I was making. But so it wasn't like total devastation, but it was a huge
tough.
Setback.
It sounds, it sounds really tough.
Yeah, it was.
You start a newsletter.
I did.
Via Substack. I'm a paid subscriber. It's only $50 USD a year, people. Pay for people's work. tell me about what you wanted it to be. Because, I mean, you had the Substack, I think, before, but then it was dormant. And you're like, oh, I'm going to resurrect it. Mm-hmm. What was the vibe? What was the mission statement there?
Well, I had signed up to have this thing called a Substack and a newsletter when I had Dining In, just so I could, like, update people on my tour schedule and all that stuff. And then when I got the column at the New York Times, I was like, well, I'm writing a biweekly column for the New York Times. Like, why would I write a newsletter? And so I just didn't write a newsletter. And then when I didn't have a column, I was like, well, I guess it's time to fire up the old newsletter. but the really freeing thing was that I started to write for myself because I didn't know who was listening. Whereas like when you're writing for somebody like the New York Times, they're like, you're writing for the New York Times subscriber and this audience, and this is who we envision them to be, and this is how it should sound. And I was able to carve out like a little bit of my own voice there, but I think most people who knew me there only knew me from recipes because the column, like the writing part, lived separately from the recipe. Like when you Google the recipe, it doesn't show up with the whole like narrative context of your recipe. But when I was writing the newsletter, I sort of was like, well, what does my writing look like when I'm just writing for myself? And it's like, maybe there's one person reading this. Because I kind of assumed that nobody was reading it. And I was so, like, thrilled to be able to work through that. Mm-hmm. And, like, find my writing style and my voice and like, write about things that weren't just food related. And people were like, wow, I didn't know you could write. And I was like, I've been writing in the newspaper for 2 years every other week, like 700 words, and no one was reading it. And so it was like the first time that I felt like people were like, oh. And I had studied creative writing in my brief stint in college, but I never thought I would be a writer. And even though I had written cookbooks, I still don't think anyone considered me to be a writer. I didn't certainly consider myself to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like to me the greatest ambition to be called that. And so when people started responding to the newsletter and saying like, wow, I'm like really enjoying the writing, it felt like I had like a totally new lease on my own self-esteem and my creative ambitions. And like, it totally changed my life. Yeah. I told somebody once that Substack changed my life when I was drunk. And they were like, don't ever tell anyone that. That is so lame. And I just did for all of you. But I kind of meant it, but only because it was like me, like really starting fresh.
And is it true that you do better from the Substack, I mean financially, than previous jobs?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the money's not in newspapers. Like, I remember when I got the job at the New York Times, I feel like I went on a trip. I like went to Paris or something. It was just like a vacation I had planned, and somebody on Instagram was like, like, looks like somebody got a new job at the New York Times. I was like, yes, that's who's paying for this job, the New York Times. Like, newspapers are not where the money's at. Like, you know, I think, like, generally, writers don't make a ton of money. That's why everybody's on strike in the United States. But it's a misconception.
Yeah. I want to talk about home movies. I mean, we're going to get audience questions soon, but yes. I want to talk about home movies because I really love them.
Thank you.
And this is like the YouTube series that you kicked off, I think, in January. Is that right?
Of 2021.
Yeah, 2020. Oh, my. 2021. Oh, my gosh. Time really has melted.
Tell me about
this. This is a different prospect because I know that you've worked on like TV shows. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But this is like a YouTube offering, and like there's a really great Thanksgiving special. We're in Australia. We don't really understand Thanksgiving here. Maybe we don't want to. I don't know.
No, it's
got
a weird
our own
holiday.
Weird histories and traditions here. But you have talked before about how it's important to keep the flaws in those videos, kind of like your cookbooks as well, I guess, or talking about like, hey, this is how things go wrong sometimes. Like, why is it important to get the bad, well, not the bad bits, but the imperfections in there?
Well, I think that we, with like the increase, the proliferation of social media and everybody living online and like having these very calculated snapshots into our lives, we all do it of like, here's what I want you to see. And because we can do that, we can make, here's what I want you to see, be like the version we want. And it doesn't make it real or based in reality. But for me, I think, especially in the kitchen, I have like a very intimate relationship with the people who cook the recipes, like thanks to the internet, I guess. But I never want somebody to feel bad if something's not going well, because things don't go well for me all the time. And I think that that is like part of my mission statement across the board, professionally, personally, culinarily, whatever, of just like things are not always going to go well. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And just sort of being all right with that. And, you know, then also troubleshooting when things don't go well. Okay, well, here's why this isn't right. And here's how to fix it. Or here's when to know, like, when to cut and run, or like when you can salvage this, or if anyone will notice, or who cares, or whatever. But I think we sort of, there's like a general like idea that we should always all nail it forever, always. And like, that's not my life. I don't know anyone whose life that is. Not a day, not a relationship, not a career, not an anything. That's always just going to be great. And so for me, it doesn't do anybody any service to like edit out the things that I don't want you to see because it's not perfect.
In the spirit. Yeah. In the spirit of embracing, showcasing, being honest about when things don't go well, I want to talk about your latest cookbook. And I want to specifically talk about the salty lemon shortbread incident.
Oh, my God. Dun, dun, dun.
I've got some glue here if you want to give a live demonstration.
Do.
I mean, like, I'm just handing it over to you.
Why don't you
lead us through what happened
God, and brought props,
what
guys.
We're supposed to do.
So you read a book, you read a manuscript 1,000 times. There's editors, there's copy editors, there's recipe testers, and yet a mistake can happen. Basically, it's a boring story, but I was trying to scale the recipe because I thought it made too many cookies. Like, what a horrible problem. Like, said nobody ever.
And so wait a minute, just to clarify, the recipe in the printed version is incorrect.
It's incorrect.
If you make the recipe, what do you get? Like a delicious sludge or something? Or
no, and some people have made it and they're like, I loved it. I'm like, well, okay.
That's not
yeah, I don't want anyone
all.
To feel bad for liking it, but it is not right. It's a more like
she's kink shaming people.
It's like I don't want to yuck your yum, but it's wrong. But it is like if you baked it as written, it's gonna give you like a chewy, jammy something. It's like a little too sweet.
Yep. Okay.
It's so just not right. It's not a shortbread, is what it's not.
Okay, I've given you some glue. It's probably not the correct glue to use for this
book.
No, it is. But you're basically offering everyone like a PDF they can print out.
That's right, people.
And you can
we have the technology.
You can manually glue the corrected page.
You don't have to do this. And some people just go in and they annotate it and they like cross the thing out and do that. But I was like, someone out there is gonna really appreciate the fact that we went and remade the page so that you could print it out if you want. It's totally absurd, and I kind of did it as like a joke, I guess, but it's not a joke. And
it's not a joke.
An incorrect recipe is not a joke. But it became like, everyone's like, when's the new recipe coming out? When's the new recipe coming out? And I was like, there are 90 other recipes that you could make in the meantime. I think once I told people that it was like coming, everyone's like, I gotta make it now.
Where is the error exactly? Is it like with sugar quantities, or is it?
It's fucked up. The whole thing is wrong. It's like, I halved the amount of butter and flour, but not sugar, and like the thing. I don't know. It's I don't know. I like retraced my steps. I was like the math lady meme. I was like back in the archives and like trying to find out where I, and there's like numbers and grams. And I'm like, this is a whole mess. I don't even know what happened.
While you're doing that, yeah. I'm just going to ask you some rapid fire questions.
Okay.
Is that
okay.
glued in now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I did glue it in.
I believe you. What do you hate more, rice or sandwiches?
Sandwiches.
You hate sandwiches.
I know. I'm like ironically really in a rice phase right now.
I actually can't.
Buttered
like
rice is
as well.
Really good.
True or false? Taylor Swift and you are totally best friends forever.
In my heart of hearts, we are best friends forever. Yes.
But you, she's written you correspondence, right?
She has written me correspondence. Uh-huh. Yes.
What did she say?
She said that she really loves my recipes, and she says that she's a huge fan, and I cried for hours, and that I got her through the pandemic, and that she heard that I loved folklore, and she really liked to imagine me cooking the folklore while she was writing folklore and cooking my recipes, and I was like, I'm dead. I've died.
I
framed it like an
that's
absolute nerd.
Cool.
I was like, well, that's getting... and. Cased in glass.
Yeah. Well, just know that if you do write fan mail to Alison Roman, she will treasure it, but...
I'm going
to
frame it, yeah.
It won't necessarily be on the level of Taylor Swift. Okay, so name one way you cook differently now to when you started cooking.
Well, when I started cooking, I was working in restaurants, and so I was definitely more restaurant-brained in that, like, I thought maybe more complicated was better or like more intricate was better. I was always trying to like, my old recipe notebooks are hilarious. It's like ideas for desserts. And it's like strawberries dressed in yuzu kosho with like white peppercorn ice cream and like candied beets. I'm like, what the fuck is that? Like, no one's going to eat that. I'm like, slow your roll. Like what is, what do you say? Hold your tickets or something?
Hold your tickets?
Somebody, well, I've learned a lot of Australian colloquialisms while I was here.
Uh-huh. Hold your horses?
No, there's like a ticket.
Like, oh, you've got tickets on yourself.
You've got Tony, where are you? okay. Hold your tickets?
Hold your...
Just tickets. You just like say
got,
tickets.
Yeah, like you've got tickets on
you
yourself.
You set me up.
Oh my God,
yeah.
I feel like I'm having a medical
anyway.
Episode. But yes, tickets.
That's the thing about colloquialisms here is you'll be like, all Australians say that, right? And someone will be like, I've never heard that. And you're like, well, I'm embarrassed.
We're not going to start her on potato cakes. Don't start a conversation with her, Australia.
I'm less fussy now, and I sort of cook from a home cook perspective.
Okay, I'm going to hand it over to the audience. But before I do, can you give us... one life-changing, potentially life-changing, I don't want to put that much pressure on you, give us one potentially life-changing cooking tip that we probably don't know, but we need to. For instance, I'll give you an example. I remember I was at a talk with Adam Liao, who's interviewing you at the Sydney Opera House, just casually. Adam Liao, I remember him telling me, like, just dropping names now, but Adam Liao was like, no, you heat the pan first. You don't have to heat the oil, like, heat the pan and then you put the oil in. I was like, is that a thing? I was like, oh, okay, that actually
changed
is
your life.
It changed my life.
Yeah.
It changed my life. What is that tip
I
for
would,
us?
I mean... I think that for me, and this is, feel free to disagree with me, especially if you're some sort of healthcare professional, but I don't wash my greens or my herbs. Like,
I thought
ever.
That was the end of your sentence. I don't wash.
Yeah, I simply don't wash. You couldn't bother me to do that. No, I think like people that, if you've ever had like a terrible salad, it's probably because it's full of water because you're like, I'm going to wash everything and then I'm going to like try and dress it. And you're like, it's heavy with water and it doesn't taste like anything. I don't wash my greens or my herbs.
You're talking in a country of recently, correct me if I'm wrong, we recently had like hallucinogens in salad greens. So.
Cool, so wash your greens always.
Or don't.
But they don't, I don't know. I feel like, my advice.
Okay, cool.
I'm sorry in advance if that results in any illness.
I love it. You heard it here first. Let's take audience questions. Let's start from this side and come to the mic and say your name.
Hi, I'm Joseph.
Hey, Joseph.
Sorry.
No.
Hi, Alison.
Hi.
Or as the gay community calls you, Mother. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Also, Ben, you were robbed on Survivor. I just wanted to make that known.
Thank you. Look, it's another conversation for another time.
Yeah.
My question to Alison is, when I read your recipes and your newsletter and your cookbook, I feel like you speak to this universality of the human experience. I feel so seen when I read your recipes and I just go like, oh my God, so me, slay queen. I just want to know what's the process behind that? Is that an intention that you bring to your writing? Is it just accidental? What's going on with your process there? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That is so nice.
Thank you, Joseph.
Well, I mean, I feel like I am writing to one person. You know, and it's not a person in particular, but I think that, like, the second that you try to write for everybody is, like, a, you know, you're sort of setting yourself up to fail because everybody's so different and you're just not going to appease the masses in that way. So I think you kind of try to write for yourself and to someone like you, so, like, a friend or a person that you already know, and it becomes a lot easier to be yourself and to, like, communicate in, like, a pretty intimate way. And it is pretty much an accident. I've always written, like, as a form of communication, like, as much, as long as I could write. It was, like, how I got out of being grounded. It was, like, how I would, you know, write letters to my best friend when we went to different schools. Like, it was, like, a real powerful method of communication. So I think that for me, it's been very natural. But, like, my grammar's terrible. I have typos. Like, I'm not, like, a very good technical writer, but I do feel like I write how I speak. And when I first started writing, like, for magazines and stuff, the writing was bad. It was really, really bad because I was writing how, like, I thought a person should write for a magazine or whatever. And my first editor at the magazine, he's like, stop doing that. He's like, just write like you. Just be yourself, basically. Be yourself is, like, so much, like, is so often the answer to most everything, which is so annoying because you're like, oh, that's so boring. But, like, I don't know, be yourself.
Thank you for your question. And
thank you,
Mother.
Yeah.
question from that mic. Hello, what's your name?
Hi, Alison. My name is Alex. And on behalf of everyone here, thank you for keeping us going through the longest lockdown.
Oh, thank you.
With your recipes. My question to you is, there's a recipe in one of your books that is the slow-baked tomatoes in oil, and you talk in that how it came from a recipe, or not a recipe, but you were trying to find a flavour that you had from your friend's mother, and that, like, association of food and memory, and I'm just wondering if you can talk about how often you tap into those food memories to create new recipes.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that first part. It is my pleasure. I think that it's weird because the first cookbook, Dining In, which is where those tomatoes come from, like, a lot of it was, like, food memory based and, like, my mom's trout and, like, Stephanie Meyerson's tomato sauce and all that stuff. But now I'm, like, because that was the first book, right? So it was my whole life put into one book at the start. And then everything after that sort of becomes less and less about a memory and more about, like, recent experience or just, like, evolving tastes or cravings or this sounds good to me, I've never had that before. So it is interesting that, like, you sort of tap into all the memories and then you use them up, like, in the first half of your career. Because now I'm like, well, the memory is, like, from, like, last month. And that's not very nostalgic. But I also didn't come from, like, a deep well of family, like, good times of, like, cooking around the fire. We just didn't do that. And so, you know, I do think there's always, like, that one thing you're chasing, or, like, I did have something that tasted like that or that feels like that, and that's how they come about most of the time now.
Thank you.
But yeah, thank you. Those tomatoes are very good.
Yeah. We are rapidly running out of time, so we're going to take two questions
at a time. I'll be faster, sorry. Giving a TED talk.
Okay, so
the time.
We'll do two questions from here and two questions from there. Let's hear over here. Hello, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Josie.
Hi, Josie.
Fan from New Zealand. I was interested in knowing about, so you share a lot of the way that we connect with you is through your personal stories that go along with your recipes. I'm really interested to know how you decide how much of your person to share. You invite us into your home movies. It's a lot to share, especially when you undergo quite a lot of scrutiny. So how does that play into the future, and how do you decide what goes on there?
I think about that all the time, basically. I think every day is a choice, and, like, every day is a different sort of question for myself of like, what am I comfortable with? Like with home movies, you'll notice like we only put the camera facing one way really. And everyone's like, apartment tour. I was like, no, I live here. Like, I don't need you to see all my stuff. But I think that we live in a world where everybody wants to share everything all the time. And I still believe in a world where we save some things for like ourselves and the people that actually know us. But it's like really just sort of like a case by case basis, because I also really believe in like radical honesty and vulnerability and sharing things. So I think that you can do both. Mm-hmm. And I still am kind of figuring out every day like how to navigate that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your question, Josie. Who's behind Josie?
Hello, I am Juliet. Sorry, that was a really loud
microphone.
Hi, Juliet.
Yeah, it's wild, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, absolute pleasure to see you tonight. I'm really interested in, I guess, the future of food. And I'm really interested to hear your opinion about our changing foodscape and our changing environment. So in particular, thinking about, you know, how should we think about food? And as you have so much influence in what lots of people eat, right? You have, you know, ingredients flying off the shelves. You know, what is your opinion about how should we cook into the future? What we should think about using as our ingredients?
Yeah, I think about that a lot. And I actually do feel like increased, you know, levels of responsibility that I take like great pleasure in. But I think that for me, like the short answer is just general mindfulness of the environment and our resources. I personally don't cook with a ton of meat. I would say my most popular recipes are vegetarian or pescatarian, which I think is a real testament to people's general appetites for what they also want to cook. And I never bill them as vegetarian or pescatarian. I never bill them as gluten-free or dairy-free. It's sort of just cooking intuitively. But also with like a direct mindfulness of like, I believe we should be eating less red meat. I believe we shouldn't eat meat more than twice a week. I believe that, you know, it's important to like really curb food waste. Food waste is like a huge thing that I think about often and that I try to sort of casually slip in, where I'm like, use the whole, you know, kale stem when you're using the kale leaf. And it's not in like a preachy environmental science kind of way. It's just, it makes sense to me. Like a leaf grows, you can eat the whole thing, you should eat the whole thing. And I think that approaching that, you know, eating less meat, eating the whole of a vegetable or something, decreasing food waste, can be taught and incorporated and folded into our psyche in a way that doesn't make it feel like effort. Like it should just be like, oh yes, of course we eat the whole thing. Yes, of course we eat mostly vegetables because it feels good and they taste great. Like I genuinely love, was it roughage?
Yeah, roughage.
I was like,
we were talking about roughage.
I was like, I love roughage. But so I think that that's what it is. But I think that I have a role in just making sure that people have good vegetable recipes to cook.
Thank you for your question, Juliet.
Thank you.
Ruffage,
sorry,
will,
yeah,
be the name of Alison's fourth cookbook.
Yeah.
And we hope that you buy and enjoy it. We've got two questions over here.
Hi.
Hello, Alison. My name is Ellen. I would love to ask you a question about home movies. Can you tell us what's going on behind the scenes? What are you doing with the crew when you're putting that chicken in the oven? What are you talking about? Are you actually waiting that full time for that chicken to cook? What's happening?
We are, so when we do home movies, we do two or three episodes a day. So oftentimes if there's like the bolognese recipe that we put out last week, it's so funny. People were like, you said it simmers for 3 hours, but the clock only moved by an hour. I was like, yeah, because we made two batches because we're not waiting 3 hours.
I love that there are Alison Roman truthers out there. Yeah,
that's like a gentle truther that people are really out there investigating. But yeah, so when things take a long time to cook, I make two of something. But typically, like if a chicken goes in the oven and, you know, we can fit another recipe in, we will do it and then come back and pull the chicken out and finish that video. Like we are like trying to make hay while the sun shines or whatever that phrase is. Thank you. I don't know what that is. But yeah, like, you know, we're working on a day rate, people, you know, we're trying to cram it in, but we're laughing, we're hanging out, we're friends, or we're like eating lunch and not talking to each other. Cause I've been talking for 3 hours straight. But yeah, we all genuinely like each other. Nothing is pre-planned. Nothing is scripted. Nothing is pre-made. We are like, it is what you see is really what's happening. Mm. So they are real.
I've watched every single episode.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And we've got one final question from the audience.
Hi, Alison. I'm Megan.
Hi, Megan.
I just wanted to, first of all, I remember when I first watched one of your home movies and in that Whereas an interview and you'd said, well, what recipe is the easiest to make if you were just going to make one and you said to do the slow roasted chicken and tomatoes. Mm. And so I went out and bought your book and I had made your chicken, and I have to say that was the first recipe I'd ever made that I was truly proud of.
Oh, thank you.
And 2 years on,
you did that.
I'm shocked to say that I'm even now in a place where I feel confident roasting a chicken and am known for the chicken amongst my friends because of this recipe.
Oh,
but
that
now,
is wonderful. We all love that for you.
But now I think I'm starting to think a little bit more about, you know, putting together my own recipes and getting a bit more creative. And what's your process when you're thinking about what's the next recipe and what foods go together and what goes in the sauce and what stays out?
Yeah, I think it's like for me, I'm like a less is more person when like not everything needs an anchovy, even though it might be delicious. And I really try to be mindful of the number of ingredients somebody has to buy when cooking. And so I'm not like a maximalist in that way, not because it can't taste good, but just because it's not, to me, practical. So I am like, I'm just waiting for somebody to call me out and being like, 98% of your recipes are like one lemon, two shallots, and olive oil. And I'm like, shit, you're right. That is true. But you know what? They taste good together. And so at this point, I kind of have like a rhythm in my own palate and what tastes great. And, you know, a new vegetable doesn't really come on the scene. So you're dealing with the same kind of stuff, right? And so it's just like, okay, well, I've cooked with a can of chickpeas or a bunch of kale or a shallot. It's just, how do you treat that? So for me, it's like less about what ingredients go together and like how you treat them, how you slice them, how you cook them, how you, you know, how they behave. That like is to me like the Rubik's Cube of recipe making for me now, because I like to do less with more. And that to me is like a really great challenge, which is why I'm endlessly fascinated with like pantries and grocery stores, because I'm like, we're all working with the same tools. So like, how can we emerge with something different each time? And, you know.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your question, Megan.
Keep it moving, Roman.
Look, this isn't my emotional like security tube that I've just been holding. We're going to finish up tonight with a giveaway.
Oh my God, an Oprah giveaway.
Yeah, we are Oprah. We don't look like Oprah, but we are Oprah tonight. Yeah. And so this is a poster that's been made by Food for Everyone. This poster is here to celebrate Sweet Enough, and it depicts Allison's raspberry ricotta cake. Should we hold it up?
I love it so much.
So it's a work of art.
It's really beautiful.
But it's also a recipe. Yeah. It's painted by artist and Food for Everyone founder Gemma Leslie. Gemma Leslie over there. Yeah, legend Gemma Leslie. If you go to Food for Everyone's website and buy this poster, each poster donates 10 meals to Second Bite. Is that right? Yes. Okay, fantastic. So Food for Everyone's a culinary poster shop that collaborates with chefs, cooks and artists to turn recipes into art. Their website is foodforeveryone.com.au. Underneath one of your seats tonight, a torn out page from the program.
Yeah.
I want to say golden ticket. So you tonight have been sitting on Allison's face. That sentence came out wrong. But you know, like...
thank you.
Who has that? Yes. Okay, yes. We have a winner. You... Please come up to the signing desk and receive your signed poster.
Yeah, I'll sign it. I'm going to sign books after this.
It's a beautiful print that you can frame. And so even though you've won it tonight, everyone else can access this print from foodforeveryone.com.
And they ship worldwide, which I got to say, I really appreciate, because as you know, being in New York, you want everyone to participate in the same thing. And so if you have a friend that doesn't live here, you can ship it to them. I've become a real fan of like giving people gifts by mail, just like sending them something as a surprise.
That's nice. You can send them this glue.
I'm going to bring this with me on the plane.
That was just prop glue tonight. Everyone, I've had such a wonderful time. I'm pretty confident you have had one as well. Could you please join me in thanking our wonderful guest, Allison Roman, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.